Today on the 21st Show, there's been no shortage of advice on how to improve one's personality. From Dale Carnegie's How to Win Friends and Influence People to the instructional films you might have been shown in school.
To improve your personality, concentrate on the other person. Find out how to satisfy the other person's motives.
My guest today put that advice and much more to the test. Writer Olga Hazan spent a year trying to go from someone dwelling in dread to being the kind of person who radiates joy. She documents that journey in her new book, Me, But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. I'm Brian Mackey with Olga Hazan for the Hour, today on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. But first, the news from NPR. From Illinois Public Media, this is the 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. How do you react when things don't go perfectly as planned? Do you like to be around other people? And are you the kind of person who always meets deadlines? All these are components of your personality.
What do we mean when we talk about personality? What is your personality? It is the way you get along with other people around you and with your changing environment. You want certain things from other people and from environment. The way to go about getting those things reveals your personality. For example, did you ever want to go one place when the gang wanted to go somewhere else? What did you do? How pleasant was your personality?
Yeah, how pleasant was your personality? And more to the point for our conversation today, have you ever wished it could be different? Olga Hazan did. A staff writer at The Atlantic magazine, she first approached this idea for a story that came out back in 2022. Back then, Kazan wrote that the results were mixed, but she wanted to try again, and this time she would spend a year on the project. The result is her new book, Me, But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. Olga Hazan joins us now. Olga, welcome back to the 21st Show. Olga, are you with us?
Sorry. Thanks so much for having me.
Oh, good. Mute. The yes. Curse of the Zoom. All right, listeners, you can join us today, 800-222-9455. Maybe you have wanted to change your personality. What did you do? How well did it work? Let us know, 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, I want to start with your vacation in Ocean City, Maryland. How did it go?
Yeah, well, like many of my vacations, it randomly happened that it rained, and I reacted really negatively to that. I was sort of pouting in my hotel room and feeling really unhappy and unlucky. And I decided to take a personality test that was designed by a researcher who studies personality. It showed that I really had a lot to work on. And in particular, I was very low on extroversion and very high on neuroticism. So I wanted to change those traits using some of the research that I had read about.
So maybe we should take a step back and talk about what exactly is personality? What do we mean by that?
Yeah, so most researchers now think that personality can be measured by five different traits. And you're basically on a spectrum. Each of these traits is a spectrum, and we all fall along the spectrum. So no one is just a pure introvert or extrovert, but usually somewhere in between. So the five traits can be remembered with the acronym OCEAN. So it's openness to experiences, conscientiousness, extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism.
So, and neuroticism, I guess nowadays people refer to that as like emotional stability as well. I took this test when we first spoke 3 years ago, and my results were kind of flipped from where they are now on that scale, because I guess they changed the terms. But talk about how we evolved to understand this. We've come a long way from the id and the ego and those Freudian ideas, right?
Yeah, so Freudian ideas really were that our personalities are kind of all in our subconscious, right? So we're not aware of them. These are like internal struggles that we have. And through talk therapy, you can kind of uncover what your secret desires really are. And what the trait theorists kind of put forward, and which has been sort of accepted by psychology now. Is that actually our desires are not that secret. We kind of know kind of what we want and what we are generally like and what we generally do. And those things are our personalities. And so the trait theorists started making lists of adjectives that could describe people. So like one early list had like airy and zestful on it, just like very strange terms, and they kind of narrowed them down and narrowed them down and narrowed them down until they had these five, which they felt like, none of them were synonyms for something else. Like they were all kind of standalone traits that described a different facet of personality.
You say that people, might want things to be different in their lives, right? Maybe they want to be more organized. They want to make friends more easily. And they don't really realize that those are elements of personality. Draw that out for us.
Yeah, so I often hear what I think is a fair question, which is why would you want to change your personality? And the answer is that your personality really defines a lot of how you live your life and how happy you are. A lot of things that we might want to change about our lives, like making more friends, is an element of personality. That's a part of extroversion. So if you're someone who's ever sat around thinking, "Huh, I haven't really talked to anyone today," or "I don't have enough, mom friends," or whatever it might be, one way to change that might be to try to boost your level of the trait of extroversion. Another trait that people often like to work on is conscientiousness, that is the trait that determines like timeliness and organization. So if you're ever sick of always running late, conscientiousness could help you kind of work on that. And then, of course, the one that everyone wants to work on is neuroticism, which is the opposite of emotional stability. And if you've ever been in any kind of therapy or on any kind of antidepressant, you're working on neuroticism.
All right. What are some of the benefits of having I guess a high score in these personality traits? Let's start with conscientiousness, because that one's maybe the most obvious, right?
Yeah, so conscientiousness is the trait that employers really like. So employers love it when you show up for work on time, and you know exactly where everything is and what the latest version of everything is and where the project stands and what else needs to be done to complete it. So this is the trait that really predicts a lot of like school success and job success. It's just being highly organized and diligent. So people like to be conscientious generally.
What about extroversion? What are the benefits of that?
Yeah, so extroversion is one where people are like, but I'm an introvert and I like it. And I totally get that. I am also an introvert kind of at heart. I've kind of tried to expand my extroversion a little bit, but extroversion is basically just how much you like to get out and about. So how much do you like to get to know other people? Do you like to talk to other people? Do you even like to do activities outside the house, even if they don't involve a lot of talking? So, like, are you in some sort of club or social organization? These are people who do stuff. They don't just kind of sit at home by themselves.
There's a guy I listen to on a different podcast who talks about how the pandemic was the best years of his life. Somewhat tongue in cheek, I think, but maybe we can come back. You actually had an article on that earlier this year. Maybe we can come back to that later. Let's talk more about the neurotic one, though, because maybe this is also self-evident, but why is it good? Why do so many people want to work on this one in particular?
Yeah, so the two components of neuroticism are depression and anxiety. And so those are two things that people generally don't like. People tend to want to decrease their levels of depression and anxiety. And therapy is one way to do that. So therapy does decrease neuroticism. Even a short course of therapy can do that. But there are other ways too, like meditation and other forms of mindfulness. And so this is really one where, once people reduce their levels of neuroticism, they kind of tend to feel more calm and happier.
All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Olga Hazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic and author of the new book, Me But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. She spent a year working on her own personality for this and took deep dives into a lot of the science behind how personalities change and how we can go about doing that if it's something we're interested in. So maybe we should talk about this idea that personalities can change, because there may be some people who studied psychology a long time ago in school and may have, you know, have this idea that your personality is kind of set by your genetics or, you know, maybe by whatever happens to you in your youth. It's kind of the you have to play the hand you're dealt in life. But that's not true, right?
Yeah, so this was kind of an early theory that personality is set like plaster, according to William James, especially by the age of 30, he thought it was like the magical age that you are just the way you are for the rest of your life. But kind of later research shows that this is not quite true. So first of all, we all change over the course of our lives, whether we want to change or not. Most people change on at least one personality trait from early adulthood into you know, the time they're like a senior citizen. So we all kind of change and transform over time. But also people change themselves. You know, whenever you do something like join a club or join a church, or if you take a new kind of job and really commit yourself to it, or if you, you know, do an improv class like I did, you can also change your personality and become somewhat different over a shorter period of time. And so that's really the research that I follow in the book, is about these interventions that help people change various personality traits over just a few months.
Yeah. And it's interesting because, you know, I think you write about this interesting small number of people who experience an epiphany that results in personality change. Those cases are fascinating, but that seems to be a minority. So I think the best hope for most of us is, like, how do you describe it? Performing behaviors associated with the new personality over and over again. This is basically fake it till you make it, right?
Yeah. So actually that's a line from one of the studies that I kind of read for the book, is faking it till you make it is one way to change your personality. And yeah, you know, that sounds bad, like, oh, you're acting like a fake person. But if you think about it, anything we try for the first time is going to feel pretty unnatural. So if you start a new workout routine, right, or regimen, let's say you start running, the first few times you go running, it's going to feel like, this isn't me. What am I doing? This isn't what I'm used to, you know, but then eventually you'll kind of get some days of running in and you'll start to feel like, huh, I kind of miss running. It's kind of my thing now. So that's kind of how personality change happens, is that we start doing something. It feels really unfamiliar at first. And then gradually it becomes incorporated into our personality.
Talk about the role of the growth mindset in this work.
Yeah. So the growth mindset, most people, think of it as related to kind of academic performance. So this is Carol Dweck's idea that in order to help kids succeed, you have to tell them, you know, you can become good at math and you can become a great reader and things like that. And, you know, there's some evidence behind that. But what I also found just in kind of doing this myself and in talking to people who had changed their own personality is that they had to believe in their own ability to change. So what I often hear from people is, or what I sometimes hear from people is, I'm an introvert. I'm never going to be able to do public speaking, for example, or I would never be able to do whatever it is, X, Y, Z. And yeah, I kind of think that if you think you never will be able to do it, you probably will not do it. And so the growth mindset just kind of tells us that having a kind of more open-minded view of yourself, you know, feeling like it's possible for you to change or possible for you to do something different, can suddenly like open that up and make it so that you can work on some of these traits that you maybe didn't think were possible for you.
One other thing I want to ask you about before we get into your actual efforts to change your personality is, you know, why take this approach as opposed to somebody asked you, you know, why not fight the patriarchy, for example?
Why not work on outside things
Yeah,
rather than inside things?
well, it's not about us, it's the world that's wrong, right? Isn't
Yeah,
that?
and for a long time I had that mentality, right? Like, it's not me, it's that it rained on my vacation. It's not me, it's that, my whatever, the editor didn't like my draft. Like, it's not me, it's, and so it was always some external thing. But the thing is that, like, those external things are always going to come up. Like, we're always going to face some level of adversity. Life is just one thing after another. You're never going to have some beautiful stretch of your life where nothing happens and you get to live out your most perfect life. So it's part of personality is how you can adapt to adversity and what you do when you face adversity and how to not let those negative things that come up in all of our lives kind of get us down.
All right, let me remind listeners, this is the 21st show. We're speaking with Olga Khazan, whose new book is called Me, But Better: The Science and Promise of Personality Change. She's also a staff writer at The Atlantic. If you have a question for us, if you want to talk about your personality and maybe some things that you have tried to change, or if you have questions about how to go about doing this, let us know. 800-222-9455 is the number. We're going to continue this conversation after a short break. This is the 21st show.
Mary Smith had a college education. Sally Jones had a scientific streak. Susie Brown used to lecture on ancient architecture. Josie Green spoke Latin and Greek. Just forgotten girls with forgotten brains. While history when Madame Pompadour was on a ballroom floor, said all the gentlemen, obviously, the madam has the cutest personality. And think of all the books about Du Barry's looks. What was it made her the toast of Paris? She had a well-developed personality. And what did Romeo see in Juliet or Pierrot? In Pierrette or Jupiter? In Juno?
And think of all the books about Du Barry's looks. What was it made of? The toast of Paris. She had a well-developed personality.
What did Romeo see in Juliet?
This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today with Olga Khazan, who is the author of the new book, Me But Better. It's a story of her year-long attempt to change her personality. We asked members of our texting group about this. We heard from Tony in Champaign, who a couple of you, who like, I should say, like a couple of you, is pretty confident in his personality. He said, my highest rating was for emotional stability, which I'm comfortable with. But I can't say the test was very impressive or illuminating in its other scores. I've no great desire to improve my personality. I'm a senior and have few social goals. We also heard from Lloyd in Danville, who said, I'm a very confident 70-year-old African-American male raised by very encouraging parents. I would never change. We also asked if any of you were willing to take the same personality test that Olga did that sort of launched this journey. Brandy and Urbana wrote that the Big Five assessment came back pretty accurately, I think. It showed, I'm not very extroverted or conscientious, but am extremely agreeable and open. Regarding the descriptions, I found little to dispute. In terms of emotional stability, though, I had trouble with the quiz. I wasn't sure if I should be answering based on my medicated or unmedicated self. My medications impact my personality in that they impact my mental state and my ability to cope with stress and life in general. She says they could also affect the conscientious aspect in terms of my ability to stay organized and productive. For me, mental illness can be detrimental to those priorities. Thanks to everyone who wrote in. If you want to join us today live, 800-222-9455 is the number. Olga Hazan, I wonder if anything from those messages resonates with you in the work you did for this book.
Yeah. So I was interested that one of the, I guess, texters, the writers, picked up on the fact that medication can affect personality. So there, I think, was one study that showed that when people got on an antidepressant, their levels of neuroticism did change. So in fact, their personalities did change. I would say that's an example of personality change for the better. You know, if the person feels like they feel more capable and more able to handle stress when they're on the medication. The other thing that I thought I would point out is that low conscientiousness can sometimes shade into almost like ADHD. So it's being super disorganized, being really scattered, forgetting where you put things, things like that. And ADHD medication can actually make you more conscientious as well. So there is kind of an interesting interplay there between, you know, mental states and mental illnesses and personality traits.
Fascinating. All right. So remind us which traits that you were most interested in changing in yourself.
So for me, the big ones were extroversion, agreeableness, and neuroticism.
So maybe we could just start with extroversion, as you do in the book. You sign up for an improv class. The watchwords are yes and. How did that go?
Yeah, so I will admit that I was terrified of it for the first, I don't know, few months, honestly. I had a really hard time even convincing myself to go. I'm not a natural improviser or a natural performer. But I kind of found that kind of much in the way that personality change often follows behavior, that I kind of adapted to it or started to like it over a period of time. It kind of grew on me. In particular, it's the fact that you really can't control or predict what happens in improv. And there's so much of my life that I have to control and predict. Just as a journalist, like, you're always having these highly scripted conversations. I don't know, I just really relish this chance to just be kind of silly and have fun with other people, and to give up control for, you know, a couple hours. So that's one that I think really helped me with my extroversion, even though I didn't really enjoy it at first.
So you write about taking this class in the DC area, right? Where people are always so serious and there's like a Hill staffer in your class.
Yes.
was it embarrassing for you? What was it like to actually let go that first time you have to, like, I guess you're like pretend throwing a ball around a room?
Yeah. So it was one of those things where I don't know if this would be considered a panic attack or not, but it was one of those things where I stood up and my heart was pounding so hard. I felt like people could hear it. And I felt like so much blood was rushing to my head that my vision was spotty. Like, I was like, I felt like I was going to like pass out or something from just the nervousness of it. Like, I was so nervous, and I hate being on display. I hate being silly. So that was definitely just that physical sensation of, oh my God, it's happening, was something that I had to overcome.
How did you overcome it? Or is it like, I got to do this for work and maybe the conscientiousness kicks in or what?
You know, I honestly do think it's one of those things where with repetition comes familiarity, right? And it's like anything else where you feel really unnatural doing it the first few times, and then you kind of just get in the groove. So this happened with me with like another element of extroversion that I do for work, actually, which is I moderate events sometimes for my job. And the first few times I did it, I was terrified. I did not do a good job because I was so scared, and it really showed. Now it really, like, I barely feel anything. Like, I get no nerves going up on a stage to moderate. And I think it's just because I got used to it. And now it's just sort of part of me. And I don't even see it as kind of a challenge for myself. I just see it as something that I can do. And it's like that with a lot of things for people.
Yeah, that's so interesting, because I'm obviously doing live radio every day. I'm sure there was a time when I used to get nervous about being live on the radio. Oh, my gosh. But that's in the past. But I mean, there are still things that make me nervous. And one of them is like the idea of trying to make new friends as an adult, which is something else you tackled. How did you go about that?
Yeah, so I joined Meetup which is a platform for going to little groups and events and things. And it's just talking to strangers for hours and hours and hours. So some of my meetups were pretty successful and pretty fun. Some of them, I really, you know, after the first hour, I was kind of done. What I would actually recommend more so than meetup is to join some sort of club where the same group of people comes every time. And I did this with a sailing club, not a fancy one. It was just on the local kind of river here with some rented boats. Just having kind of a consistent group of people and having an activity we were doing that wasn't just talking to each other, made it a lot less awkward and a lot more fulfilling. So that's what I would recommend for people who are on the introverted side, but still looking to connect with other people.
That's great advice. All right, let's talk about neuroticism. And maybe you can talk about some of the ways in which that manifested for you, that made you want to change it.
Yeah, so neuroticism is really, it's internal. But for me, a lot of it was just constant kind of worrying and rumination. You know, the typical stuff that anxious people do, going back and rereading emails and, you know, re-litigating kind of conversations that had already happened. I also was having a lot of sleep deprivation around this time, like really bad insomnia, waking up a lot at night to worry. I had kind of tried everything. I was and am in therapy. I had recently gotten off antidepressants because I didn't feel like they were doing much for me. And basically every single thing in the reduce your neuroticism literature pointed to mindfulness, which I really did not want to do again, but nevertheless jumped into.
Yeah, this is, you know, before we get to that, I mean, at some point you think of neuroticism as almost like a superpower, right? Something that powers your productivity at work, for example.
Yeah, so for a while I was like, well, I can't stop being anxious because anxiety is what keeps me going. You know, it's anxiety that gets me to, you know, finish the draft by the deadline, or it's anxiety that gets me to, you know, check my phone at night to see if my boss messaged me or something. But really what I kind of came to realize is that I didn't really need anxiety to do my job or to be effective. Anxiety was kind of making me revisit my decisions a lot and kind of go over my plans and kind of like, again, relitigate things, but it wasn't actually motivating me to succeed. I was already kind of internally motivated. So part of it was just untangling anxiety from kind of, you know, hustle, or like anxiety from, you know, a desire to achieve. I think a lot of people with anxiety struggle with that, though. They think that one is powering the other.
All right. So you mentioned meditation. How do you get into meditation?
It was a challenge for me. So I am not Mrs. Meditation. I was not someone who would wake up every morning and like meditate on a cushion, you know, or anything like that. So I would say the easiest thing I did was to sign up for an app that had short guided meditations on it. So these were sort of 10 to 15 minute meditations that would kind of walk you through what to think about. So it would be, you know, repeating these like loving phrases toward yourself and others, or walking you through some sort of guided visualization or something like that. That worked pretty well for me, just having these little almost like audio tracks that I would listen to. When I kind of decided to move past that though and into unguided silent meditation for 45 minutes at a time through this class that I took, and that was a lot more challenging.
I can imagine. I mean, you know, there are a lot more people who have tried meditation than are consistent meditators, and that includes myself. How did you get over that hump?
Yeah, so I'll say I didn't completely get over the hump. So I did do the meditation for the class. I didn't, you know, cheat on my homework or lie or anything like that. And the class lasted, I think, 10 weeks or maybe 12 weeks. So I did do it the whole time. It was 45 minutes of some mindfulness activity every day. And the only thing I can say about meditation is that sometimes it works even if you don't think it's working. So one of the principles that they teach you is that the first step to meditating is to not stop trying to like rid yourself of anxiety or stop trying to like focus your mind on something in particular. It's sort of just about kind of accepting things are moment by moment is how Jon Kabat-Zinn puts it in his book. And that was really challenging for me, but what I found is that my neuroticism score actually did decrease, even though I felt like I was never really sure if I was doing it right. Like there's something about meditation that I think is beneficial, even if you're not kind of one of those seasoned yogis who's on the cushion.
Yeah, no, you talk about Dan Harris, who is the former ABC News guy, has a 10% Happier is his book. I read that one as well, and how that resonated with you. And I think he told you early on, right, that like if you can't stop your intrusive thoughts is the phrase they use, then you're doing it fine. That's not like a wrong thing, right?
Yeah, and part of it is just learning to kind of sit with your intrusive thoughts and to be less afraid of your anxiety or to be less, I don't know. There's a lot of so in Buddhism they talk about like the double arrow, which is like you feel the anxiety, and then you kind of get mad at yourself for feeling the anxiety, right? You're like, oh, why am I anxious? I shouldn't be anxious. Everything's fine. And so a big part of reducing your distress over this is just to feel the anxiety and to not kind of castigate yourself for the emotions that you're feeling. So that I don't know, that was part of it for me.
What did your family and your partner make of these experiments and this journey you were on?
I didn't really tell my parents that I was doing it, but my partner was supportive. Rich, my husband now, was very supportive, especially of the meditation and the neuroticism components. I think he was not crazy about the meetups because sometimes I would ask him to come with me on the meetups. And he really did not like them. And he's a big introvert and really doesn't like talking to strangers. So I had to, he was like, look, you can do this, but I'm not hanging out with these people for 3 hours on a Saturday.
What about conscientiousness? This is not one you struggled with, but I'll say it is something I took that same test you did on the website, and it's my lowest score by far. You know, I do pay my taxes on time. I'm helped by the fact that this radio show is live at 11:06 every day, whether I'm ready or not. But, you know, if I want to push that number up, what are some things I can do?
One thing that's been shown to be effective, let me back up. So one thing conscientious people struggle with is that a lot of the tasks within conscientiousness are really boring. So it's like sending a million emails or doing your taxes or creating some boring PowerPoint slide deck for work. And these are not intrinsically rewarding activities. And people who are low in conscientiousness kind of struggle to motivate themselves to do like eat this broccoli of life. Like they just kind of don't like to do what they don't like to do. So
I'm
one thing
feeling
that
very
is,
seen right now. Yes.
so one thing that can work is this thing called episodic future thinking, which is essentially just like pre-experiencing the end goal that you're working toward, so that you can kind of power through those tedious like interstitial steps toward it. So let's say it's filing your taxes. It would be like getting your tax refund in the mail and getting a big tasty dinner out with your refund check and getting the steak and like where are you going to go and how are you going to spend it. You're not going to get that tax refund unless you actually go through the steps of filing your taxes. So sometimes this can be kind of a motivator to get people to do those boring things. Angela Duckworth, who's the grit author, kind of does a version of this where like it's like connecting those like tedious things to a larger goal in your life. So for her, it's like her teaching helps her get through, making PowerPoints or grading papers or whatever it might be.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take another break. We will continue this conversation when we return. We're talking with Olga Hazan, who's the author of the book Me But Better: The Science and Promise of Personality Change. You're listening to The 21st Show.
I don't like the money and the jokes I'm funny. Is there anyone who has a personality? I've heard your best pickup, I've put on the makeup. Can we stop this and skip to the personality?
This is the 21st show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking with Olga Hazan, a staff writer at The Atlantic and the author of the new book, Me But Better, The Science and Promise of Personality Change. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455. It's 800-222-9455. Olga, did this experience make you more sympathetic or empathetic to others who maybe have some what we might call personality challenges in their life?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I did this, so I do think it's doable to change elements of your personality or certain traits, but it's very challenging. In particular, neuroticism is something that's really hard to change, and I think is one that a lot of people struggle with. Some of these traits like extroversion, like you just have to go out and talk to people, you know, that's scary, but ultimately, like, once you're doing it, you're kind of doing it. But with something like neuroticism, it can be really ingrained in your daily habits and in your ways of thinking about yourself and other people. So it's not just like flipping a switch, you know, it's something even the researcher who I profile, Nathan Hudson, says you have to really want to change, and kind of, you know, every therapist kind of is probably nodding along here that, like, a lot of people come to therapy and they, kind of say they want to be less anxious, but then don't actually take any steps to reducing their anxiety, because it can be really hard to let go of a part of yourself, even a part of yourself that's not really serving you. So I definitely have a lot of empathy for people, and I'm hoping to just kind of shed light on how you can start to go about this if this is something you want to do.
So how much of this change that you made in your life has stuck? If you've encountered backslidings, you know, in the process of writing the book and coming out and talking about it and doing interviews like this one?
Yeah, it's interesting. So I would say the biggest, my scores all changed to varying degrees in the expected direction. But the biggest thing that this allowed me to do was actually reduce my neuroticism to the point where I was able to actually get pregnant and have a child, which I now have. Spoiler.
Congratulations.
thanks. I honestly was too anxious for most of my adult life to even contemplate parenthood, even though it was sort of a goal that I had for myself. It just felt too overwhelming. And because of how much I like to control things, it was something that was too kind of open-ended, and I couldn't handle that level of giving up control, I thought. So this kind of allowed me to get over that and to actually move forward with my goal of becoming a mother. I would say there definitely has been periods of backsliding, but that's pretty normal. So in postpartum, like so many other women, I had postpartum depression. So that was, I took a personality test like two or three months after my son was born, and my neuroticism score like went shot straight up higher than it had ever been. That's typical. That happens from time to time. It's all about kind of knowing how to get back to a better place. And so the techniques that I learned kind of helped me, and also Zoloft helped me get out of that and actually return back to a point of stability.
Yeah. Can we talk about some of your recent writing in The Atlantic as well?
Sure.
You've done a lot on parenting and family dynamics. What is the default parent?
Yeah, so the default parent is this idea that a lot of institutions that deal with kids, like schools and pediatricians' offices, still think of the mom as the parent who should be contacted if there's ever an issue with with the child. So there was one study that I write about that showed that even when the dad contacts the school and is like, please call me if there's a, you know, to arrange a meeting or whatever, the school will still call the mom whose number is also listed. So it's just sort of exploring why that is and kind of how we can start to break out of that. And interestingly, I talked to a lot of dads for that story who want to be the default parent, like their wives have really intense jobs and they not so much, and they would like to be kind of the first contact or the primary parent, but are still having trouble getting institutions to accept them that way.
Yeah, feeling seen again. What are the consequences of this, especially for, you know, the women in that arrangement?
Yeah, so I, one person, it didn't make it into the article, but one person I talked to was Jessica Colaraco, a researcher whose book kind of talks about how America doesn't have a social safety net. It has moms. And just the fact that moms can never kind of fully devote themselves to work. Like, you always have the she described it to me as like the work news ticker and the kid news ticker in your mind. So like, even when I'm, you know, in a draft working hard on something, I still am thinking about my son and like when he needs his next bottle and whether he needs, you know, ibuprofen or whatever. So that it's kind of like a further drag on what women can accomplish in the workplace if we don't respect the fact that sometimes men are the default parent.
Yeah. You also write about parental fatigue. What's behind this? I don't know if you call it an epidemic of exhausted parents.
Yeah, well, so part of it is just that parents like are interrupted at night because their kids wake them up, right? Which is makes you tired. But interestingly, parents are tired even if their kids are sleeping through the night. And even if they report getting at least 8 hours of sleep, they still report a large amount of fatigue and exhaustion. And one reason could be that people just need a lot more time to do nothing in their day than they're getting, especially parents. So just knowing myself, like I wake up, I take care of my kid, I immediately start work as soon as his childcare starts. And then as soon as his childcare ends, I immediately go back to taking care of him. And then I, you know, finish up work for the day and then I go to sleep. And, you know, there's kind of some growing kind of evidence or theories that we might need more slack in our day than that. Like, we can't just go, 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 and then sleep. We need some time to just kind of let our minds wander and kind of refresh without being fully asleep.
Yeah, no, that's great. And I cut into sleep for a lot of years and still do sometimes to get that time. And I don't know that I could recommend that as the best course of action either. Let's tie this back to your other work. How does personality play into handling the stress of parenting?
So for me, one of the most helpful things I came across when I was working on neuroticism was oddly not from Buddhism and not from meditation or mindfulness, but from David Axelrod, the Democratic consultant, who said, whose quote was, so if you're thinking about election day, right, it's sort of like, it requires an incredible amount of giving up control, right? Like, you're working so hard, but then ultimately you can't control this outcome on election day, who's going to be the president. And the way he thinks about it is all we can do is everything we can do. And I try to remember that when, because there's so many times in life and in parenting and in work and in everything else where you just can't control the outcome. You can, take your kid to a bunch of PT appointments, but you can't ultimately control when they're going to walk. You can't ultimately control whether your kid is going to be like a good eater or a good sleeper or not. There's just a certain amount that they are going to be in charge of. And all you can do is everything you can do to set up good circumstances for it to kind of unfold the way you'd like. And so that was, I know it sounds kind of simple, but that was really kind of a breakthrough idea for me because I had spent so much of my life trying to control outcomes and it was making me miserable.
Yeah, that's good advice. And I got to say, it keeps going, right? You can't really control how much they're going to enthusiastically practice piano or whether they'll make the soccer team or
whether they're going to be a lawyer or a doctor or whatever.
Yeah, yeah. Or, God help them, a journalist. Beyond the postpartum depression, not to minimize that, that's obviously very significant. But have you found that being a parent has changed your personality in other ways?
I think I focus a lot less on small inconveniences now because my life is so inconvenient. It's like there's this like old Jewish proverb where it's like the man goes to the rabbi and it's like my house is too small for me and all my children, and the rabbi is like, bring the cow into your home, and the man does, and he's like, but rabbi, now like the cow is like in the way of everything, and the rabbi's like, bring the donkey into your home, and he's like, now the donkey and the cow are fighting. So anyway, the like moral of the story is that like if making your life a little bit more inconvenient shows you how great it was before. And I kind of feel like parenthood has done that. Like I just don't have as much time. If I get a mean text from someone, I only have like 20 seconds to think about it because I have to go clean up some poop or, sing Baby Beluga or whatever else I'm doing.
That is some deep truth right there.
Yes.
What will you do next? What's next for your reporting and writing?
Oh my gosh, I'm in between things. I am working on a story right now about blood glucose monitors and whether we should all wear them.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Yeah, you write about that in the book too. We don't have time to get into that though. All right. So let me just say, Olga Khazan is the author of Me, But Better: The Science and Promise of Personality Change. I guess if you had to leave people with, one sort of overarching thing that you want them to take away from this work, what is that?
Your intro music said that personality for to change your personality, focus on the other person. And I would actually say that the reason to change your personality is to focus on yourself and to make yourself happier and to help you live a better life and to achieve everything you want to do, not for other people.
Yeah, no, that's great. Obviously that Coronet Films instructional video from the 1950s, we've come a long way since then.
Yes,
So,
yes. Yeah.
all right. Well, Olga, I really enjoyed the book, and I want to say it's one of those. I'm not a huge self-help reader, but this was, and I don't even know if this qualifies as that or if it's more of like science and psychology. It's a bit of everything. It's really funny. I really enjoyed reading it. Thank you so much for talking about it with us today on the 21st show.
Absolutely. Thanks so much for having me.
And that is all the time we have for today. Once again, the book is called Me, But Better: The Science and Promise of Personality Change. The author is Olga Khazan. You can also find her writing at The Atlantic Magazine. Coming up on tomorrow's program, former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan will soon have to serve 7 years in prison, the result of his conviction for corruption. We'll talk about that and other news out of the federal courts with John Seidel of the Chicago Sun-Times. We're also going to have an interview with another author about a book about a Chicago woman who became essentially the godmother of children's music, music for very young people. It's a story that hasn't really been told before now. That's all coming up tomorrow here on the 21st Show, which is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening. We'll talk with you again tomorrow.
Over and over, I tried to prove my love to you. Over.